and welcome to episode 411 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Nathan Fox. With me is Ben Olson. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. With us, we have a special guest, repeat guest on the show. It's Kyle McEntee. He is the senior director of pre-law engagement for Law School Admission Council. Kyle, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing pretty good.
Welcome back. Always nice to see you. So, Kyle, you are the founder of Law School Transparency, which was then integrated into LSAC about a year ago. I'm going to try not to say LSAC on this episode. We always say LSAT and LSAC, but people who are actually working there say LSAC and actually LSAT. Cool. So, Kyle, you joined us most recently on LSAT Demon Daily, episode 228, to talk about LSAC's resources for applicants and future law students, including Admission Unmasked. I don't know, maybe we could lead with that. How are things going with Admissions Unmasked?
Yeah. So we did Admission Unmasked again this year. It's been great. We changed up the format slightly. So it's fewer live events, but the live events we did were Q&As or Ask Me Anythings with experts. So I think those have been going really well. People are liking the ability to just like get in there in a more relaxed environment and just ask the questions that are burning.
Kyle, can you step back for a half second and just tell people what Admission Unmasked is?
Absolutely. So one of the very first projects that I wanted to do when I started at LSAC last year was really think about how do we give a comprehensive overview of what it is to strategically and effectively apply to law school. Because I think there's a lot of information out there. And I think LSAC has a lot of expertise and resources that needed to be aggregated and organized in a way that actually helped people do those things effectively and strategically, two of my favorite words. So Admission Unmasked is just an overview of what are the application components? How do you decide where to apply to law school? Do I belong? How do I figure out if I'll belong? Do I even want to be a lawyer? What do lawyers do? And really the goal is to start at a high level, but also drill down deeply enough so that people can feel more confident in their ability to apply to law school and get in and make a sound choice for them based on whatever their goals are and their ambitions are.
So it sounds like a course that you can take at any time, or you also sounded like you had events that were at a specific time.
Yeah. So last year, it's a mixture of asynchronous and synchronous live content.
Can I do a little reading comp lesson, since this is like an LSAT podcast and we're teachers, right? I'm reading the description here. It's right off the top. What is Admission Unmasked? The Admission Unmasked program consists of live Q&A events and asynchronous learning modules organized by topical themes. And Ben and I have laughed about the word asynchronous on the podcast before, because I like to use that word. And Ben is like, hey, dork, why are you using big words that people don't understand on the podcast? Which, fair enough. Okay, so just the reading comp lesson here is like, whoa, what the hell does that asynchronous mean? And people can freak out if they just read that sentence. But I want to point out two things. One, you're contrasting it here with live Q&A events, which was right before that, right? So live Q&A events and asynchronous learning modules. What might an asynchronous learning module be as compared to a live Q&A event? And from there, you might be able to infer that asynchronous means not live, basically recorded. But the thing I really want to point out, because the law school admission test does this all the time, it gives you an unfamiliar word, and then the very next sentence says, the learning modules are on demand. And so they're giving you this is totally accidental on you guys' part, but this is an example of exactly what happens in LSAT reading comprehension. Is, oh no, a scary word. There's lots of syllables in that word. And then if you just hang in there and keep reading, they go, well, that basically means that it's on demand. So there it is. It's an on-demand learning module. Sorry, I had to nerd out.
Well, this might have been coincidental, but I'm pretty sure I wrote that last year or at some point. And that's good writing. right? So I
mean, to give the definition of the words that people might not get.
Right, exactly. So I mean, that's, I don't know. I think that's a great example though for how we approach reading comp, and a great tip.
Perfect. I'm sorry to interrupt, but you were talking about your program.
Yeah. Yeah. So like live, it's live and not live asynchronous components, right? And the asynchronous components, you know, it's videos. There's some podcasts in there from the I'm the Law podcast. There's short textual blurbs, there's infographics, there's other graphics. Basically, it's a mixed media method of delivering information in a way that is effective and based on sound learning theory. But basically, we take both approaches. So there was more live events last summer, but we've had time to develop more and better asynchronous content since then and turn some of the previous live content into asynchronous content. And lets us focus more on just giving people the live events as an opportunity to ask questions. But that is ongoing right now, but it's not too late because it is structured like a course. Now, it's a course you could do on your own pace, right? But I think it's July 24th, we will release the current version as Admission en Masse On Demand 2023 or something like that. I'm not sure exactly what we're calling it.
Oh, so you can just get all this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And
there's probably a couple still live events left. Oh yeah, there's one on Wednesday, July 19th, and there's one on Thursday, July 20th, back-to-back live Q&A events coming up. At least that's what it says on your webpage right now.
And that means it's accurate, I promise.
Okay, cool. Good.
Love, and this is free, right? All you it need is free. Law
Absolutely
account.
Free.
Yeah. Okay.
Awesome. Okay. So register now for that if you want to check it out, or it sounds like you can check it out asynchronously anytime in the future.
Yeah. And we're That's on lsac.org/admission-unmasked.
Or you can just go to lawhub.org and go in that way. Mm-hmm. We actually just launched lawhub.org about 2 weeks ago.
Cool.
Should we talk about the Supreme Court decision since it's on everybody's mind?
Sure.
You, Ben and I have already talked about it on the show. There's no, we want to get a new perspective.
Yeah. I mean, look, the perspective I consistently deal with relates to the perspective of pre-law advisors and the pre-law advising community, as well as the students who are trying to figure out, what does this mean for me? How do I make my application choices? And I could say that law schools are still digesting and analyzing the court's decision to understand how they proceed. So like, we're definitely in a bit of state of paralysis. So LSAC, for our part, we're continuing to help to work to provide schools with the information and resources they need. We've been doing that for months now leading up to the court's decision. And actually in 2 days from now, so we're recording on July 11th, on July 13th, the day of the DC forum, we're actually having a special event for law schools in Washington, DC to continue to help them through figuring this out. What I'm hearing from schools, you know, they are committed to understanding and abiding by the court's decision. And they're also continuing or committed to continuing to pursue their missions, which in many cases does include advancing diversity, equity, and access to legal education and to the legal profession. That said, there's still a lot of question marks. The best advice at this point is don't let this change where you're applying to law school. We might learn more. It might impact schools more than we're expecting, but we just don't know at this point. And so, you know, it's still important to figure out, what are your target schools? What are your reach schools? What are your safety schools, using primarily LSAT or LSAT and GPA? We do expect schools are still going to want to enroll diverse classes. How they do that legally, that's going to be up to them and working with their general counsel. But I have no doubt that schools are going to still have that be part of their mission.
Yeah, that's how, I guess, how it struck us too, that the court's ruling makes it pretty clear that you can't be explicit about it, right? We read aloud the Harvard undergrad, the whole thing about the LOP list and all that. And it was just like, hey, man, you're at this stage where you're cutting people at, it's called the LOP list. And it's just like so bad for, you know, like optics, I guess. So you got this thing called the LOP list, and one out of your four criteria at the point when you get onto the LOP list is explicitly race. Okay, well, that clearly is not going to stand, right? That's what was struck down. But are there other ways that you can get at that without being so explicit and blatant about it? And I guess that's what the schools are going to be talking about with their general counsels.
Yeah, and I would encourage all students who are applying, go talk to your pre-law advisors. You know, they will be talking to LSAC. They'll be talking to me and my team. We'll be trying to keep them informed of what we're learning from schools, so that way they can give good advice. Because that's really what we're all after here, is we're trying to get good advice into the hands of students so they can make informed application decisions, so they can end up with a list of schools that they've been admitted to, that they can decide, you know, is it worth it for me or not?
You know, Kyle, as you talk, I'm thinking about all the, I don't know, the tasks or the responsibilities that LSAC has taken on, right? Like if you asked me a few years ago, what is the purpose of LSAC? I would say to make and administer the LSAT, right? But it sounds like it's going way beyond that, right? What is the mission of LSAC?
Yeah, I wish I had the mission in front of me because I don't have it memorized.
What's your gut? What's your sense of what you're trying to accomplish?
Well, I mean, we're at our core, we're trying to advance justice in the legal system, right? And a big part of advancing justice is ensuring that we're enrolling a diverse group of individuals from a lot of perspectives who are able to represent clients in the legal profession as members of the legal profession that need representation. And so the LSAT from the beginning has been a tool of equity, right? It's been a tool that has helped students of color enroll at a greater rate than they otherwise would have. And so I think that's always been at the core. But we've also been expanding under the leadership of our president and CEO, Kelly Testi, the role that we're taking. So one of the primary ways we view ourselves is as a trusted advisor. So it's a trusted advisor to the law schools themselves, and that's the admissions professionals and increasingly career development offices, deans, academic support professionals. But it's also as trusted advisors for the pre-law advising community, including pre-law advisors and pipeline programs. And that's trying to ensure that those people have the resources that they need in order to help their applicants find out where to apply, how to apply, how to apply well. And then on top of that, trying to help the students who are applying to law schools, the prospective students, decide, should I apply at all? How do I study for the LSAT? When do I take it? Then administering the LSAT, and then through the Credential Assembly Service, helping them apply to law schools. And then helping students along their entire learning journey from pre-law into law school and then into practice, both in terms of helping them, again, as we've talked about a lot, prepare good applications, make informed choices about where to attend, but then also getting started at law school on the right foot. So we've got the Ultimate Law School Prep Program, which is part of the Law Hub Advantage subscription. And then there's resources throughout the first year of law school to help you be a better student, be a better learner. That really, I think, will help people develop the skills they need to succeed in law school, but also to ultimately succeed as lawyers. So yeah, it's a lot more than it's been. But I think your perception of LSAC prior, it's not unreasonable, but that's what we're trying to do now, is let people know that we are about way more than the test. Way, way, way more.
Cool. Let's talk about, are there forums coming up right now? Is that a timely topic?
It is a timely topic. So the first forum of the year is actually going to be history by the time this releases, because it's actually on July 13th in Washington, D.C. But starting in September and then going into October, November, we'll be having both in-person and digital forums, both for JD students and LLM students. They'll be in Chicago, Toronto, New York, Atlanta, LA, San Francisco, and Miami. I believe I got them all. But if you go to lsac.org, the top, you'll be able to find the forums, and you can register today for them. Highly recommend it for both the students and as well as pre-law advisors to go and meet the law schools. So in DC, we have over 150 law schools that'll be there. So you can go, and it's the same at all forums, right? If you can go, you can talk to the admissions professionals, learn about what's special about their school, learn about their application timelines and what you can expect. Sometimes schools will hand out fee waivers there. So that's a nice little incentive. There's also a workshop that we put on, and that, you know, it's basically admission essentials. And then there's also a resource center. And this resource center includes a test prep provider center. So people can go and meet test prep providers. They can go and talk to a pre-law advisor, go talk to financial aid, come talk to me or Katya Valasek, who is my director of pre-law advising. And we can, you know, answer questions about the application process. And, you know, it's a good experience. I really do highly recommend it to any students who are applying to law school or thinking about applying to law school.
There was a thing that stuck in my teeth. I went to one LSAC forum. This was 10 years ago, probably. And there's a thing that stuck in my teeth that I saw there that I'm wondering if it's still there, because I have a feeling it would grate on you as well. there was a slideshow presentation about law school financing. And there was a PowerPoint slide that had a stoplight that they were using as a metaphor for debt. And it was red light, credit card debt, red light, bad debt, credit card. Don't go into credit card debt, red light. I'm like, yeah, totally. Next thing, yellow light. And I think the example of a yellow light that they gave was an auto loan, where it was like, you may or may not need this, caution, but maybe you proceed with an auto loan. I'm already kind of going, most people
see where this is going, Nathan.
Well, we've complained about it on this podcast a million times, so it's only fair that you have a chance to respond. But they get to education debt, and they've got just this big green light up on the slide, and I was dying. I was just like, no, please don't tell these young people, they're so impressionable. And you're just, and the slide is like, oh, but don't worry at all about debt that you're going to incur in order to go to law school. Anyway, you can respond.
Yeah, no, that's terrible. We will not do that anymore. I don't know how long it's been since that happened.
But it was like 10 years. I mean, it was forever ago. And I'm still,
I don't know when the last time it was done.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It could have been done 2 years ago, but I'm confident it hasn't been done in the last 5 years.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, that's not our approach, right? That is a very school-centric approach where it's like, enroll anyone at any cost. But that's not even the attitude of most law schools these days. Law schools have actually evolved their thinking of urging caution on debt, saying, you know, don't come here at this price or with this, without the expectation of something else, right? They want people coming in on an informed basis, because that's how you end up with happier students and happier alumni. And so, no, that's not something you'll ever see from us again.
I mean, it might not even have been you, right? It could have been a speaker at your, but it was at
it's an LSAC forum. That's our responsibility. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
So
very Kyle, happy to hear that.
I do want to talk about this idea that you're saying that law schools are more sensitive, maybe, or more aware, or more, you know, concerned about the debt load that their students are taking on. I wouldn't be surprised that that is the case. My concern is what that means. Like, well, anytime you talk about money, right? There's all sorts of ranges on the spectrum of what is okay. And I guess I have, I have four of my own kids, but six kids because I have a blended family.
Brady Bunch.
But yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of kids and two of them are already, you know, one's already in college, one's heading out to college this fall. And so when we talk about costs, right, a lot of times it depends on what you compare it to. So you can compare it to a private four-year institution and they're charging $60,000, $70,000 a year. And you say, oh, well, gee, 40 sounds great. But to me, 40 is still just astronomically high for 1 year of tuition. Like, it just blows my mind, right? And so then they're like, okay, well, what about a school that costs 20? And it's like, okay, that's getting better, but it's still like an astronomical sum. If you think about it, for 8 months of education, you pay 20 grand. And I don't think that a lot of people, and especially younger folks, have a good sense of how much work it takes to generate that sort of cash. And so then when you start talking about loans, well, you know, that's something that's going to be in the future and it's spread out over time. And you're talking about payments that are monthly. So now it's making it sound even smaller, but it's not. It's actually going to be bigger because it's going to be all that interest. And I don't know, like, it's encouraging to hear that law schools are more concerned about the debt load, but I'm afraid that it's too little. You know, it's too little of a advocacy, you know, a fight for that individual's financial future.
I guess if prices aren't coming down, I mean, they're going up. And if enrollment numbers aren't going down, then the law schools could say they're into this. But are they? I guess, yeah. Kyle, what have they been doing to demonstrate that they actually do care what kinds of debt loads students have?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's partially a matter of perspective, and going back to the traffic light analogy where, you know, they were like, green light, all education debt is good debt, right? That is an attitude I spent more than a decade with LST fighting against, right? Trying to change the media narrative that law school was a ticket to financial security, like, and arguably people were still saying it was a ticket to financial success. And you know, law school was too expensive. Law school is still too expensive. Employment rates have gone up. Salaries have continued to go up. Salaries have at least kept up with inflation. Tuition over the last 2 years has not kept up with inflation, which is good news, but it's still too expensive, right? But I don't think you would hear anyone in an admissions office anymore say, it doesn't matter what you borrow, you should come here. Right. Whereas I think that is the attitude that was permeating law school admissions 10, 15 years ago. So I think that's more what I'm commenting on, more than like the people in the admissions office doing their best to figure out ways to bring tuition down. I don't think that's their role. I don't think they've got the authority or power to do that. But what I do hear from a variety of admissions professionals is them being upset when their school spends money on something that could have gone to tuition, tuition discounts or scholarships, right? Heard that from admissions people. I heard it last week from several law school deans. So, you know, that's a new attitude. And, you know, is it too little? Yeah, probably, right? But it's also difficult to make change rapidly when costs are baked into these institutions. And that's why you need federal loan reform and other sorts of accountability measures through the accreditors, whether it's the ABA or regional accreditors of universities or the Department of Education. That's what's going to be required to solve the systemic problem. But at least I feel like the people are not blind to the systemic problem or in denial about it anymore.
I do agree. It seems like a federal solution, right? Restricting federal loan dollars, for example, is going to hurt. But it's also that hurt that leads to innovation, right? Like, okay, what do we really need to spend money on? And you don't do that until you have to.
Oh, maybe they'd stop playing the scholarship games. I mean, we've complained on this podcast on every episode for 400 episodes now. We've complained that, you know, when you give people 100% tuition discounts, well, then you know, scholarships, right? Because many schools offer a big portion of their class full ride scholarships. And where does that money come from? Well, it comes from the other students who are paying their tuition. And so that's why you have a nominal tuition of $50,000. And so some people are borrowing the $50,000. Meanwhile, other people who probably have a higher LSAT and higher undergraduate GPA are paying zero. So would you agree that a federal, like a cap on, I mean, because we do have a cap on undergrad loans, is that right?
Yeah, we do.
But we do not have a cap on grad loans. Where are we on? I mean, if we cap those grad loans, then doesn't they have to adapt, right?
Yes, they would have to adapt. But This is an enormously complex topic.
Yeah.
So what happens if you, let's right now we've got Stafford or what are they called? Direct loans, right? And it's up to $20,500 or something per year.
That's for the grad loans. It's up to $20,500 per year.
That's for the direct loans at the lower interest rate.
Direct or subsidized? Is that what you mean by direct or?
No. Well, there are no subsidized.
There's no subsidy. So that's only for undergrads. Because I know with undergrad, the cap is $5,500 for the first year, $6,500 for the second year, and then $7,500 for the remaining years. And I think you can do. And then there's an overall cap of like $31,000.
But then you can go above that with plus loans. So parent plus loans at the undergraduate level and graduate plus loans at the graduate and law school level, right?
Yeah.
And there's no cap on those. That is, if there's going to be legislation, it would be on capping graduate plus loans or eliminating them altogether. The problem, though, is a matter of access and equity, right? So if right now the way those work is they've got a set interest rate for everyone. And if now you push that back to the private market, they would then be making their choices based on the financial position of the borrowers. And so unless there was some kind of cap on interest rates, probably using some kind of federal usury statute, for example, I think what you'd end up with would be very high interest rates for people still able to borrow that amount with some downward pressure, because there are some schools across the board, graduate level, not just law schools, that private banks would not lend, especially if they're not guaranteed loans like they were before 2010. But you end up with this issue of, well, the whole point of student loans in the first place is to expand access to higher education. And so how do you continue to expand access without having people be exploited or just not get access at all? And so it's a lot of balance, interests that need to be balanced. And that's what I think makes it so difficult and why I'm glad I don't have to be the one making the decisions. But I do think that if you were to, like, not looking at the consequences on access, if you were to say no more grad plus loans, you would see prices come down. There's no question about that. But what are the other consequences, and are they better or worse than the status quo? And I'm not sure of the answer on that one.
Kyle, I do want to point out two things and push back a little bit here. I understand that the goal, at least from what I'm hearing you say, the goal of these loans is to increase access, right? But we just read on the show, and it's one study, and there are going to be other studies that counter this probably, but they say, hey, look, it doesn't look like it's actually increased access for the groups that you're presumably targeting, lower income and then underrepresented minorities. And so it sounds like on some level it's not working, right? And then I also think of this other thing that just I was listening to the other day on Freakonomics. It was mind-blowing. I don't remember what school it was, but they said, hey, you know what? We talk about aid and we talk about loans as a form of aid, right? But it's not really aid because you're just going to have to pay it back later. And so what they did is, I can't remember. I wish I knew the exact specifics, but they said, instead of offering loans as aid, what we're going to do to these lower income applicants is offer grants. The school is just going to give them the money. And they only saw, I think it was like a 3% increase in people taking those grants. Like the number of people who were going to take the aid and apply only changed by a very, very small amount, which I wish I remembered the details better, but the show was saying basically people did not distinguish between a grant and a loan. To them, it was the same.
I mean, that to me is a communication failure, right? Because if people were informed on that, there's no way people would act that way, right? So,
well, this school was giving away money. I think they're trying to, they're not, a loan to them is money. And so they're not taking that payment. Instead, they're offering a discount. And so we could try to dig into that more and try to understand, but I think part of the point was even when you're trying to convey, hey, look, this is free money, people don't seem to understand. And so, yeah, anyways.
Yeah, no, well, so on the first study, I think I'd have to see it to be able to comment on it more. And then I guess the same for the Freakonomics podcast, to be able to comment on it more. Generally speaking, I think people will line up and act rationally on money if they have the right information. And that's what that comes down to, is transparency and providing good advice. And so that would be the primary things that I would be looking at that episode of Freakonomics through, like the lens, would be how transparent were they? What methods of communication? When did they reach them? Who was providing the information? And then see if that might not throw a wrinkle in our understanding of why students were not acting rationally. It's really difficult to imagine someone being offered a loan versus a grant and then choosing the route that where they got to pay back the money. And it just doesn't make any sense to me.
There's lots of examples of people not behaving like pure economic actors, right? The economic theory differs from people's actual behavior in lots of different ways. It's clear that if we get rid of student loans entirely, then we would get rid of the problem of people graduating with mountains of debt that they're never going to be able to repay. It's also clear that if we did that, we would then be getting rid of the whole point in the first place, which was to allow, you know, some people to go to law school who would never be able to go.
Yeah. And there's like, starting from the premise of eliminating all student loans, what does that even look like, right? There's eliminating Title IV funds from the government, right, as a lender. But so, like, yes, there's the Congress does have the authority to do that. Whether they would or not, it's a political question. And as you pointed out, it's a balancing access versus cost. But what would they be able to do about banks? I'm not sure that Congress could write a law that wouldn't get struck down that prohibited bank from lending.
We also know that without the federal loans, law schools just straight go out of business, right? I mean, isn't that what happened with Charlotte?
Somewhat. Yeah.
Right.
And that's right. That is what happened with Charlotte. Exactly.
Yeah. Just for people who aren't aware, there was a law school for Charlotte, North Carolina, had a law school. And when the U.S. Department of Education decided to stop allowing them to have federal loans for law school at Charlotte, and as soon as they stopped that federal loan access to that money, it was like, poof, law school gone. So we do know that there are a lot of school. I mean, it seems like there would be schools like Charlotte that just wouldn't exist if it weren't for access to this spigot of money.
Right. And we've seen a number of schools fall off in that way, right? It wasn't just Charlotte. It was Florida Coastal. It was Arizona Summit. We've seen some mergers. We've seen some other closures. Indiana Tech comes to mind. We've seen a lot of the worst offenders of abuse. Those schools have closed down. So that's good news over the last 10 years for, I think, legal education, for the profession, for those who actually have a commitment to access, because those schools, they might have provided good access for a few people, but on balance, they were doing more harm than good. And that's the way you have to analyze access schools, because it's very easy to stake a claim that you are an access school, but they need to put their money where their mouths are. And that's what the education department said to Charlotte was, you're doing way too much harm here. We are not going to let you do this anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Anything more on the financing issues before we move on to other topics from either of you? No. Okay. Kyle, you said you were excited about AI and its impacts, which are, of course, most of which are unknown at this point. But what's going on from your perspective?
Yeah. I mean, again, I'm going to talk about this through the lens of advice to pre-law students, because I think people want to embrace generative AI, which is really specifically what we're talking about here. Because there's all kinds of AI that have been part of the application process for a long time, going all the way back to, I don't know when spell check was invented, but we're at least 25 years in on that, right? But there's autocomplete, there's Grammarly. I mean, it's all on a spectrum, but now we've gotten to the world of generative AI, where there are actually these large language models that are able to generate volumes of text that they can then use either as a first draft or as a, well, hopefully not, but some are probably doing it as a final draft. But from in admissions, there are still a lot of question marks. Law schools are still trying to figure out what to do. They're writing new policies. They're changing their policies. And so I would just urge caution to anyone who is trying to use generative AI as part of their law school application process. Not because I don't think it's the future. I mean, it is the future of the legal profession, right? And law schools are already looking at how to use this in their curriculum, right? And lawyers are using it as a tool in their practice. Now, some of them are misusing it, right? And citing cases that don't exist.
yeah.
But the being a lawyer is a lot about taking what exists already and repurposing it for your own needs. And you should never take a boilerplate contract you found online and use it as a lawyer, right? But it's okay to start with a sample or a template and then make adjustments and think about each clause and move from there, right? And so I think that's where we end up with essay writing and using AI to help people generate ideas and generate outlines. But you have to be very, very cautious, right? Because each law school an applicant applies to is going to have a different policy right now. And some of these policies are not very informed policies. And so you just have to be very careful because you don't want to end up caught lying on your application because that will come back to bite you when you apply for the bar.
So there could be a question there that's like, did you at all use generative AI as part of this application? Yes or no?
Right, exactly.
Kind of a stupid question to ask because why can't I use it to, like, why can't I feed it my resume and a paragraph about myself and say, hey, write me a 1.5-page personal statement for law school? Why can't I do that as a rough first draft? It would probably do a pretty solid first draft. The problem is that it's going to also hallucinate facts about you and it's going to make shit up and put it in there, which you then could edit out. But I guess if you had done that, you could not then faithfully answer no to that question on the
right. And so there's like, we could have a normative conversation all day about like, what should the policy be?
Yeah.
Right?
How we don't even know, right?
But we don't know, right? Yeah. And so you got to play the rules of the game you're playing. Yeah. Otherwise you're going to get booted out. And so
wait, I feel like I know. I feel like we have to use it. Like, I don't know. I just don't see a world in which it's not going to be like spell checker. Imagine if they asked, hey, did you use a spell checker when you submitted this?
Yeah.
You're like,
sure. But your argument, your justification here, does that help a student this year who is applying to law school and has to check yes or no, I used it when?
Sure. Yeah. I mean,
like that, again, that's what I'm trying to say. It's like, we could have these normative discussions all day and like, I would come down where you are, right? This is the future. We need to embrace it. But right now it's not clear that that is the perspective of the admissions committees at law schools. Mm-hmm. Some are going to be okay with it. Some are going to be very against it. Some are going to be somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. Be careful is all I can say.
Yeah. If they're going to ask you that question, then you need to be able to answer that question honestly.
Mm-hmm.
So then that might inform your decision about whether you do or do not want to use it. How important is it to you that you're able to use this to come up with a rough draft of your 1.5-page personal statement? It's probably not that important today, right now.
Right. Now, that said, there's nothing wrong with using generative AI to practice interviews, right? If you have an interview coming up, No, that might be a good way to
ask me some interview questions for law school. Yeah,
right. Exactly. Now that's likely not going to be inconsistent with any of the policies. But again, take a look.
It might make you have to check yes on that box, though.
Right. That's what I mean. You got to check it to make sure it doesn't. But yeah. It's hard to imagine that would. My guess is that most of them will be specific to essays. But again, you have to check every school. It's a different application in their policies.
So schools are putting this question on there, huh? A lot of schools are?
I don't have the numbers on it yet, but schools are working through their policies. How they'll communicate them will probably differ by school.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have, and some schools have already had these policies for a long time. It's just the words mean something different in the era of ChatGPT.
Are there public data about law school applications aggregated? Like, that would be so interesting to know how, what percentage of schools do X versus what percentage of schools do Y.
Yeah, not yet, but that is something on my radar.
Oh, cool.
Because I think it would be helpful for discussions like this. So it's not theoretical and, you know, boring advice, like double check everything.
Yeah. I mean, but you're going to be a lawyer, so double check everything. Read it carefully. Actually read it. Read it carefully. Answer thoughtfully. You're going to be a lawyer. So anything else about AI before we move off of that topic?
No, I think that's it. I mean, I think law schools need to be thinking carefully about what they're trying to measure to decide whether these policies make sense in the first place. But I think they will think that through. It's just, it's going to take some time, and the application cycle starts right around the corner. So
do you personally use generative AI as part of your work or as part of your daily life? I get the sense that, Ben, you're dabbling in it every day.
Every,
I look at it never.
2 hours. Yeah.
Kyle.
Yes, I've used it for sure.
I have used it. I just don't use it actively. I don't know what I would use it for.
Yeah, I'm probably somewhere between you two. I'm not using it every 2 hours, but I've found it useful. Again, the hallucinations are real.
Yeah.
I once asked it to analyze my writing style, and it did a pretty good job of it. But then I asked for my bio, and they told me I was a 2010 graduate of the University of Michigan Law School who worked in a big firm before starting Law School Transparency, which is just not true, even close to true. So, you know, it hallucinates, but sometimes it does well.
It's great at hallucinating. I used it. So for personal purposes, I used it to try to write some backstory for a Dungeons and Dragons character. It did awesome. Like, it totally killed it. Then in a different session of gaming, I tried to get it to build me a Gloomhaven deck for a certain class and a certain level. And it confidently gave me 100% bullshit. I mean, it looked super good and it was all lies. I mean, just completely fake. And it was like using all the buzzwords. It looked so real. It looked so good. And then I'm reading through it. I'm like, what? The class doesn't even have that card. What are you talking about? It's complete bullshit. And so obviously complete bullshit. I was telling it, I was like, that card doesn't belong to that class. And it just does it. And it just kept spouting off the same nonsense. So then I don't know. I was like, whoa, this is, you got to be real careful with this.
Yeah. I mean, look, this, if you were to try to go use that at a tournament with that deck, or like, right, it would show you've got really bad judgment. Right. And I think the same thing can be said about like a personal statement. Again, we're talking normative here.
Or a lawyer who brings a brief to court.
Right. Exactly. Right. So like, always double check everything, right? Especially when you're not the primary source. And again, it's a shortcut that could be useful in lots of different ways when you're allowed to do it, but be careful.
Yeah, I definitely think you do have to be careful. I just think it's amazing what when I'm trying to find information, it's not that it's the final source, it's that it introduces ideas that are related to the topic that you just wouldn't find, I think, by Googling, unless you end up reading a lot. It just says things. It's like, oh, and by the way, blah, blah, blah about this. And you're like, okay, let me go Google that. Like, I hadn't even thought about that idea. It just brings ideas together. I use it all the time.
Hallucinogens can be good for that. I mean, it's like you do, like, there's a lot of people who believe that LSD and mushrooms and everything is like helps you to make lots of connections that you wouldn't have made otherwise. So that's how it is. That's how it looks to me, is that it starts spouting off stuff and it's like, oh God, okay, here's an acid trip into the internet of, yeah, lots of ideas coming at you.
Yeah,
for sure. Cool. How are law schools thinking about this? Do you have any like anecdotes about what law schools have said about AI?
It's really all over the spectrum. Uh-huh. I think there is an attitude of, among some, the same as Ben's, like, this is inevitable, let's just get there. Or they'll say, this is what's happening in my law school. It's a tool that they're using because lawyers are using it. So we shouldn't be against using it. But again, that's all the behind the scenes stuff. What that actually turns into a policy is going to depend on the dean of the school. It's going to depend on the general counsel of the university. It's going to depend on the faculty who are in the admissions committee. There, and there's some that are just like completely against it, which is why we end up with the, well, what should you do? Well, it depends.
Okay. Random topic generator here, but it's like, I'm the AI host of the podcast. We, this last week in class, my Zoom chat was popping off because people were in the queue to register for an actual testing session. And apparently, according to my students, there was some snafu with Prometric. You want to give an update? What's going on with all that?
Yes, there in fact was a snafu. It was widespread. So this was the first dual mode scheduling attempt that we've done, right?
Dual
so
mode, again, is just the option to be able to take it in person.
Exactly. In person or online or remotely, right? Always the same experience, though, through WallHub. Just depends on where you're sitting. But there were some programming glitches on Prometric's side. And so while we don't yet have a root cause, the scheduling tool at Prometric now is online. It has worked perfectly since Thursday night. Our team was working with Prometric as soon as we got wind of the problem, and we communicated it about as soon as we could. The reports on Reddit, the emails, contacting support, they were all incredibly helpful. So I want to thank everyone who alerted to us to those scheduling problems, because that did help move the process along more quickly. But again, we're not happy about it, but we are working with Prometric to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
I was surprised that even people who are taking it at home are using a Prometric scheduling tool in order to facilitate that.
Correct. Right. So you go into the same place to do the scheduling, because we've moved entirely to Prometric for the crux of the LSAT.
Got it. What percentage of students are choosing in person versus at home?
I'm not sure yet what the data are showing. In our preliminary surveys of what people wanted, it ranged on survey from anywhere from like 40 to 60%. So like wasn't really a consistent answer, which has made the logistics of planning for this actually pretty difficult. But yeah, we'll have more data on that. I'm not sure exactly when, but that is something we will release at some point.
Yeah, I guess it doesn't matter. I mean, I'm curious, but it really doesn't make any difference to me, because that's going to be an individual choice.
Yeah, and really, this is what we heard from people, which is why we want this direction. I mean, look, this makes it more expensive for us to administer the test to do right. Both, right? But that's what people want, and that's what they need. And we want them to have the ability to make the choice for themselves. Like, where are they going to do their best? Because we want them to do their best.
I agree that people should take it where they're going to do their best. My opinion is that most people should probably be finding a quiet place at home or office, or like an environment that is familiar to you and that you can control. And for many of our students, you know, they're taking their practice tests in their bedroom or whatever, and that works great for them. And if they want to have an official test that replicates their performance on their practice test, which is what we're constantly advising people to do, you know, don't take the official test until you're happy with your practice test scores, because we have 100 practice tests to work on. In that case, it just seems like, okay, so you're happy with your practice test scores that you've been taking in your bedroom? Cool. Take the official test in your bedroom. But of course, there are people who don't have a quiet space, don't have stable internet.
Or someone like me who would go to a test center and like their brain would be turned on and like firing on all cylinders as a result of being in that new environment. You know, again, like you said, I think it's very personal. And I'm glad we've given the opportunity to people to just do what they're comfortable with. And hey, they could take the test multiple times in multiple ways if they want and see what works best for them.
Cool. Kyle, anything else that we were supposed to talk about but we dropped the ball on?
No, nothing we were supposed to talk about, but I will give a plug to the podcast, I Am the Law.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it was.
I don't think we pre-agreed to that.
No, but I wanted to, and I actually looked up your feed. You do have a couple new episodes. You took a bit of a hiatus, and now you're back with a couple new episodes.
Yeah, we did take a hiatus. So the show is a show about law jobs. Each episode is a different interview with a different lawyer to help people understand what do lawyers do. And so, yeah, new episodes coming soon, probably. I'm not sure exactly when. Sometime in the next few weeks, we'll start releasing more episodes, and we'll try to do at least 30 this year. So we've got a lot coming on that.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that's a bold. Producing 30 podcasts is a challenge.
It is. Welcome. I'll tell you the interesting thing is that doing the sponsorship sales, doing the interviews, doing the editing, that's all easy. The hard part is actually finding the guests. Because since COVID started, it's been way more difficult to cold email people and be like, hey, come on our show. And 95% of the time, it's met with complete silence. Even though anytime someone does respond, they'll say, oh, I really wish this existed when I was applying to law school, because they get it. But yeah, people are just not reading their emails in the same way they used to. And so that's the biggest challenge in the 30. It's nothing else. It's crazy. And frustrating.
Cool. Super frustrating. Well, if you're looking for guests, you could maybe reach out to us. We have, people who are graduating and getting their and having legal jobs. I don't know if you talk to law students or like recent grads, or if you're only.
Yeah, looking. We tend to expect grads to be at least two and a half years out, because they don't really understand what they're doing until then.
True.
Yeah. And we don't want people like talking about things confidently, like ChatGPT, when they really shouldn't be talking as confidently as they should. But we find that like 2.5 years, 3 years in, they kind of have their feet under them.
You all just heard it right there from Law School Admission Council. Stop listening to your friends who are 1Ls or 2Ls, because they are going to be telling you things about, they're going to be giving you advice about law school admissions or like what you should do. And they do not yet know what it's going to be like. They're 1L, 2L, you know what a year of law school is like, but you do not know what legal practice is like. You don't know what the job market's like. You don't know a lot of things.
It goes back to judgment, right? Like, understand who you're talking to, where their expertise is. Their expertise is in their experience in law school. Even if they got good grades, do they really know why they got good grades? Probably not. You should probably trust the academic support professionals of the school who have seen hundreds of students. Trust them. Don't trust the person who happened to get great grades, or maybe it's because they type really fast. Yeah.
Great. Kyle, thank you so much for coming on the show. Again, you're always a great guest. You're always welcome. I hope you'll reach out and talk to us.
Happy to connect, and maybe we'll see y'all at some forums coming up.
I don't think we're on your calendar for this year, but we would love to hear how it goes with your rebooted forums, and something that we would certainly consider next year. Kyle McEntee is Senior Director of Pre-Law Engagement for Law School Admission Council. Kyle, again, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you both. Talk to you later.
Yeah, thanks.
We've got an item here, Ben. You found this on Reason.com, which I understand to be a pretty conservative-leaning news outlet.
I wouldn't be surprised. I didn't know anything about the site, but this was shared with me, and I said, okay, at least what I'm reading in this article makes sense to me. I have no idea about anything else on this site. Yeah. But yeah.
If nothing else, I think that our listeners might want to read this through, because I read it, Ben read it. We both thought that it was making some pretty sensible arguments. If nothing else, it's a good lesson that we should be getting out of our own little media bubbles to try to get commentary and analysis on new stuff. But we have a new income-based repayment plan. Is this actually law? Is this new?
I think it's
a proposal from Biden.
It's a proposal from Biden. Yep.
Headline says, despite SCOTUS smackdown, Biden will still extract billions from taxpayers for student loans. So you can tell there's editorialization there right in the headline. This is going to be a piece of opinion. This is going to be a commentary piece from Emma Camp from July 3rd. on reason.com. Subhead says, Biden's proposed income-driven repayment plan could still cost taxpayers billions, and it will likely raise tuition too. I read through it. It seemed like a reasonable argument. Do you have the crux of it? What's happening here?
Actually, I don't. Maybe you have the crux of it better than I do, because I think I read this before you did. What I do know is, stepping back for a half second here, right? The Supreme Court decided to strike down Biden's plan to forgive a bunch of loans. They said, hey, you can't do that. That's not your authority. That's Congress's. That's what I vaguely took away from the decision. I don't know exactly. But the point is Biden can't forgive these loans in the way that he had wanted to, maybe through executive order or something like that. Yeah. And then this article is coming in and saying, okay, well, then Biden has another plan. He's saying, okay, I'm going to try to pass this legislation that tweaks the formula for income-based repayment. If you don't know what income-based repayment is, or what is it? Income-driven repayment, IDR. That's where, when you have a student loan and your income is low, they can reduce the amount that you have to pay back monthly. Right now, though, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, there's a big problem with this income-driven repayment plan, in the sense that if you owe $100 a month, but your income dictates that you only have to pay back, say, $50 a month, if that $50 does not cover the interest that you owe on your loan, then that excess interest is tacked onto your principal. So when you're in income-driven repayment, your principal could actually be increasing even though you're paying some amount every month, which is wild, right? Because now your debt is not only not locked in place, it's actually growing.
You're making payments and your debt is going up.
Yeah.
That's income-based repayment.
Yeah.
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 And so this new plan is to expand that to where you make it more likely that that's going to be happening.
Yep. Expand those who qualify for it, right?
And then in 10 years, he's going to be able, that's his plan, is that in 10 years, it's kind of like, I mean, cynically, it's a great thing for a current politician to promise, because it's like, well, in 10 years, this will be forgiven. And that's like, in 10 years, Biden will be well out of office, and, you know, like some subsequent administration will change it anyway. So it's one of these, like, it's a freebie, right? Because I can make these promises now. It costs me nothing, helps me get support.
Yeah. Yeah.
According to Reason.
Yep.
The biggest effect of the new IDR is likely to be a rapid increase in college tuition, with graduate programs most affected. While dependent undergraduates can only borrow $27,000 over 4 years in federal student loans, graduate students have no such cap. As a result, the new IDR will encourage many graduate programs to push their costs higher and higher, and schools will likely justify the increase to students by directing them to take out an IDR to cover exorbitant tuition. It goes on, ironically, Biden's student loan overhaul incentivizes colleges to hike their prices, all while claiming to be a solution for too costly college. The problem is that Biden's plan views expensive college as an unfortunate yet inevitable evil. Instead of enacting policy solutions that would encourage schools to lower their prices, like restricting the supply of federal student loans, Biden proposes giving payouts to students who purchased an education at a higher price than they should have, and this payout is projected to cost taxpayers up to $360 billion over the next decade. I'm not worried about the cost to taxpayers. Like, I don't really give a shit about that. Mm. The part that concerns me is just, you're setting up an incentive for law, for grad schools, for all schools, undergrad and grad. You're just setting up these incentives for schools to continue to jack their rates. I've never understood. I mean, and I'm a progressive, right? Like, I consider myself to be, I mean, I'm not like into politics or anything, but I'm a pretty liberal person. Like, do you want to tax me more? Yeah, you could probably tax me more. Like, I don't feel like I'm suffering, you know, and I understand that there are government services that are worth money. And So anyways, I consider myself, if I had to pick a team between the red team and the blue team, I'm going to pick the blue team, right? I mean, I'm not a Democrat by any stretch of the imagination, but I lean left on most issues.
Yeah.
But when I read this, I go, yeah. Or when I hear Bernie Sanders talking about like forgive student loans, it's like, you can't do that without also fixing the cause of the problem.
Yeah.
How do you're
adding fuel to the fire, right? You're just like, oh, look, these things just go away. So
No, I mean, it's like blatantly insane to me to be talking about student loan forgiveness without also at the same time talking about how do we avoid these loans in the first place.
Yeah.
Because what good does it do to just like, oh, I mean, it's like, well, that's a great way to get 20 somethings real excited.
Yeah.
Oh, we're going to forgive all your student loans. Yeah. Fantastic. And then it's like, OK, now here come another crop of 19-year-olds into school. And look what just happened. All the 29-year-olds got their debt magically erased. So now if you're 19, well, then the rational thing to do. People don't always behave rationally, but they do behave rationally in many circumstances. And if this is the system where it's like, oh, borrow all the money you want and then it'll be forgiven in the future, then why wouldn't you borrow all the money you want? Like, how does this not drive up the price of college?
Yeah, it's crazy. I would say it's irrational because I wouldn't want to depend on a government program in this way as a student. But it doesn't matter because they're already predisposed to want to take out these loans to go to whatever school they've been excited to go to. So now you're just giving them one more reason to make that what I would say is an irrational choice.
Well, I guess it's irrational if you think it through, if you realize that like that forgiveness program might not be there for you 10 years from now.
Or you have to be in income driven repayment status, which means you have pursued a lower income job, right? Like,
yeah.
Right. It doesn't make sense. It still is a poor like life choice, but it doesn't matter. It just becomes yet another excuse for the schools to raise prices and for kids to feel okay about making that decision or even good. They might even feel good or like, yeah, I won up the system. Yeah.
I wish we would have kept Kyle on the show to ask for his comments on that issue because he does seem like he knows a lot about the loan systems, and I'm sure he would have had a thoughtful response to all that. Sure. We'll have to get him back on to talk about this issue.
I mean, look, and it would be nice to have Kyle here and really other experts. People do say it's a complex issue. I think economic things are inherently complex. You pull on one lever, how the hell is that going to affect 10 other levers, right? At the same time, I think we can just step back and say, okay, I don't understand the whole system. But when you pour trillions of dollars into something, you're going to see more of it and you're going to see higher prices. Like that doesn't seem like earth-shattering economic theory.
Yeah. And curing the symptoms of a thing is not, it's like just wildly, it's just so obvious that if you're just only treating symptoms, then you're not gonna be actually fixing the problem unless you have a permanent fix for the symptoms. But like, is that what you're saying? We're just gonna forgive all student loans, or we're just gonna year after year after year we're gonna continue to just forgive everybody's student loans? I mean, okay, that's a decision we could make. Let's think through what would happen if we did that. Now there would be every incentive
for why not just anyways,
just make it free, right?
Like,
just
make it public or whatever.
Single payer, right? Like, let's just cut out the middleman and just not even, excuse me, I'm choking. Not even loan the money to the students in the first place. Just have the government just pay the tuition.
Yeah.
But that's clearly, you know, that would be very unpopular. We can't do that. So instead, we just have this weird disconnect where we got all these politicians out there yelling about like, oh, we're going to forgive your student loans. And like that looks good for people who have student loans.
Yeah.
And I guess it also is one of these things that probably people who don't have the loans don't give a shit.
Yeah.
So you can like get you know, you can get supporters. That's like part of the problem with our broken ass two-party system is that you're not actually trying to get a consensus on an issue. You're just trying to get focused interest groups that will support your team. And so if you come in hot with like, no, I'm going to essentially give you $20,000 by forgiving your student loans. Well, then there are some people who are going to be like on your side because of that one issue. And meanwhile, all the other people don't even think about it. They don't even register it. So it doesn't cost you anything to make these arguments. Anyway, I'd love to know what our listeners think. There's got to be another perspective on this. So, you know, if you want to write in and give us the counterpoint to this Reason article, we would love to hear your thoughts. Just go to thinkinglsat.com and fill out that web form there and tell us what you're thinking about this issue. You'll have to do it concisely because we have a character limit. But if you do it concisely, we might write you back and say, hey, we'd like to hear more of your concise argument in favor of this plan.
I do want to read this one quote from
Fantastic.
Freakonomics. It's right on this topic. And this is one of the things I was trying to talk to Kyle about, but I didn't have the quote. Anyways, it says, we know empirically, this is from episode 377 of the Freakonomics Radio podcast. The title is The $1.5 Trillion Question, How to Fix Student Loan Debt. And it says, we know empirically, it's no longer somebody's theory, that flooding the marketplace with third-party subsidies, grants and loans and so forth, enabled higher education to keep raising its prices. The New York Fed is the most recent of many to identify this phenomenon. And basically, they find that for every dollar of new public subsidy, colleges have raised their price between 60 and 70 cents. And they link to the Fed study and...
Shocker. Yeah. And it is kind of like economics 101. I mean, it's just if there's more money there, then there's going to be more of that thing. And duh, if there's more money available, it's going to push inflation, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about here is inflation. Look at what happened. Like, what have we been doing recently with the economy? They've been raising interest rates to try to discourage, like they're trying to restrict the supply of money so that
and
there's
the housing
not so
market
much.
Has stopped. It's
No, it's instant. It's like direct. It is a pretty direct effect that if you make it more expensive to borrow money, then there aren't going to be as many people borrowing money. But if you do the exact opposite of that, if you subsidize the loans or if you promise forgiveness of the loans, then you make it cheaper to borrow money, which makes more people want to borrow money.
Well, check this out, too. We just read in the Reason article that the dependent undergraduates can only borrow $27,000 over 4 years.
Yep.
Right? Okay. Now check this out. I am in the Freakonomics episode again. And it says, of those who graduate from a public four-year university, nearly 60% have debt with an average of more than $27,000. I'm just stopping right there. Like the federal cap is $27,000 and 60% have debt with an average of more than $27,000. So they have a little bit more than the cap. Shocker. Like the cap is dictating so much. People act like, they can choose any amount they want up to that cap. It's like, no, the schools are saying, look, you can, but we know it's a weird negotiation position, right? Like if you went into a car dealer and you're like, hey, I want to buy this car. And they're like, I can see right here on your credit report that you can borrow $27,000. And look, our car right here is $32,000.
Of course. Yeah, that's exactly. No, I mean, they ask you what you're. Yeah. And don't ever answer this question, by the way, or if you do, lie. But like you go into a car dealership. What's your budget?
Yeah. What's your budget?
What do you want? What do you want your payment to be?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, well, OK, so they're trying to figure out what the maximum is that they can sell you so that they can sell you the maximum.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of, I suppose this could be an urban legend, but I believe that when the federal income tax was first enacted, they were like, okay, so we're going to put in the possibility for the federal government to raise money by taxing individuals on their income. That was a new idea.
Yeah.
It was an amendment, wasn't it, to the Constitution?
To allow taxation. Yeah.
I believe that it was one of the amendments when it first came out, and I'm probably totally botching the facts, but there's a kernel of truth in this, I believe, that there was kind of at the last minute that they added a cap on how much, like they added a cap on what the income tax could be. And that
like the percentage.
Uh-huh. And in some of the legislative history, it was like, well, we're not going to need this cap. And the numbers that were bandied about were way beyond what anybody in the judicial or in the legislator, wherever they were doing this debate, they were like, what? We're going to cap it at 10% or whatever that number was. And they're like, oh my God, that's way too high. We'll never reach that cap. There's no way. And so somehow that cap got put in there.
Mm.
And then it was like a year later, that's exactly what the tax was at that cap.
Yeah.
And it just
that must have been demolished because we've seen rates as high as 95%, right?
Yeah. So I think that that's something that has evolved over time. But the point that I'm trying to make there is just that people are going to try to borrow the maximum. And I think specifically even with the caps, the cap can become a way of like, it's you mean it as a ceiling, but then it also becomes a floor.
Mm, yeah.
Right.
Well, it normalizes, right? You're like, oh, right. If that's the cap, then that must be the normal amount or the okay amount.
Exactly.
Or the acceptable amount. Yeah.
Yep. No, yeah. I mean, because they just like and I remember that's how it was with when I was borrowing money to go to law school. I remember them. It's like they present it to you as part of a package where it's like, well, you can borrow up to this amount under this program. And then they just like, it's just like, so they assume that you're going to borrow the max under that. And then they go to this other, oh, and then in this other program, then you can borrow up to whatever, like unlimited, essentially, for graduate loans.
Yeah.
Okay. I think everybody agrees that there's a problem. I think we could probably find common ground that like striking down student loans entirely is not really on the table.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, we're not going to say let's outlaw all student loans. I bet you find people at Reason who would want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, federal government doesn't belong in this. We should get out of this business entirely.
Yeah. Yeah.
We do, though, need to find a middle ground because I think it is still the case that people from less advantaged backgrounds graduate with more debt and worse outcomes than people who come into this from better outcomes or from better backgrounds.
Well, that's a really interesting point because I think Kyle was saying, hey, wait a sec, you know, the federal loan interest rate is fixed for everybody. And so in theory, this helps people from a disadvantaged background from getting loans at a lower rate than they otherwise would. Is it working though? Like if that's true, if what you're saying is true, right? All the flat interest rate does is make it easier for people to get loans that maybe shouldn't get loans. I mean, people don't want to hear that. And they're like, well, now you're denying access. But it's like, what's better? I don't know. I mean, this is the problem we have with people getting accepted to law school, but then paying full price. It's
I don't think that's a secret. Like the reason why the government has to get involved is because if we left it to the private market's going to be like, I'm sorry, but you're a bad investment. Like we can't loan you this money because we think the outcomes are not good enough to justify it. Like we will be worried about your ability to repay this loan.
Yeah.
And so when the federal government steps in, then it's like, well, we're not worried about Uncle Sam's ability to pay this loan. So we can loan whoever as much money as we want. And that clearly does have an effect of enhancing like access. The part that worries me so much is that it also gives schools the incentive to jack up their tuitions to outrageous levels. And I don't think that people are getting kept out of law school because they can't get these direct loans. Because I think people do end up getting the direct loans. It's just that those direct loans also come with, I think one, they are backed by the government. They're just not subsidized by the government. Like I think that the federal government is ultimately on the hook for that. If you borrow money for graduate school and, you know, and like never pay it back, I think that the government is on the hook because otherwise I think the market would not provide those loans.
Yeah.
You know, for the, for the bottom feeding law schools, and we can debate where that line, you know, where do the bottom feeders begin? Is it 200th in the country? Is it 100th in the country? Where is that line?
Yeah.
But we know that if the government steps out of guaranteeing these loans, a lot of those bottom feeders just go away.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's one last thought. I hate how health insurance operates.
Oh, but same. I just was saying yesterday that I envision in the future either not having health insurance or having the cheapest possible health insurance to comply with whatever law says I have to have health insurance, and then completely ignore it, like just never using it, like paying $400 a month and just never try to even put anything through insurance. In fact, I already do that with my prescriptions. I buy prescriptions from Amazon Prime, and it's cheaper than if I had used my insurance.
Yeah.
If I use my insurance, even through, if I use my insurance, I will pay more than if I just fucking buy it from Amazon.
That's what Maria and I did this year. Actually, we went to the cheapest possible insurance, because it's like so many problems when you're trying to get help through your insurance providers, they just don't seem like they're the experts or they know what they're talking about. And it's, I don't know.
So salespeople, and then they're, you know, like the second you try to make a claim, their whole job is to deny claims.
Yeah. That's just all you're on the phone for an hour, and it's like, oh, and you know it's by design. It's not, oh, we're overwhelmed with
calls. Can we get this person to go away? Oh, yeah, the perpetual voicemail. We're experiencing a higher than usual call. Oh, really? Again, it's the 1,000th day in a row. It's unusually high call volume. Yeah. Yep. So you guys actually did it. You guys actually like essentially cut the cord. You have the bare bones minimum thing.
One, required by law, and two, you know, it's the theoretical catastrophe backup. It's if the shit hits the fan.
Yeah, open heart surgery, you're in the emergency room, you want to have like catastrophic healthcare coverage. Insurance.
Yeah.
But if you need to go, I mean, pretty much for anything.
Mm-hmm.
You're just not like you're not planning to use your insurance. You're planning to like choose your own doctors, go where you want, negotiate with them. Probably they'll charge you less than they would have charged the, like, cause
they have those deals. You say, oh, I don't have insurance with you. And they go, okay, that's fine.
Oh, good. The price. It's cheaper for you.
Yeah.
Because when you do have insurance, then they're like, okay, well, we're going to charge you this wildly exorbitant price.
And then we're going to be negotiated down by the insurance company. Yeah.
Oh God. It's infuriating. Anyway, what were you going to say?
Well, the only, I don't think this is a good idea because I already hate our current system, but it's like, if the federal government is going to be providing student loans, they also need to almost like have a caveat, right? It's like, okay, yeah, we'll provide loans to this student, but we negotiate the price with the institution.
Yeah. That's the thing that's not happening currently.
Right. Yeah.
Right. It's like the whole gross broken system has not yet evolved to that, but maybe it will evolve to that.
Yeah.
Where they're going to come in and they're going to say, oh, you have, and then I guess people who are paying cash will just say, hey, wait a second, I'm paying cash, I get a discount.
Yeah. And then the system is going to morph and try to adapt to this. Yeah. Oh my God. Wow. Well, okay. Just as an individual, if you're listening to this still, try to avoid debt as much as you possibly can.
Yeah. Red light. I mean, just like the default presumption is don't fucking borrow money.
Yeah.
You don't need to borrow money. Make money and then choose what you're going to spend your money on. But when some like easy credit, we know that that's bad. 0% APR on this brand new credit card, and you could max it out and 12 months later, they're going to charge you 35% or whatever it is. Like, we know that those things are bad. Student loans are really not better.
Yeah.
I mean, because without the cap, like, you can borrow way more. I would say it's worse than credit cards, right? Because you can't just go get a credit card with $100,000 limit. No,
they're starting you out at $1,000 or $500 sometimes, even, right? They're like, right. Yeah, that's what we'll trust
see.
You with.
We're going to give you a little bit of rope here, and let's see if you can make these they're hoping that you'll just make the payments instead of repaying them in full. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have a credit card and you pay it off every month, you don't pay any interest ever.
Yeah.
But if you have a credit card and you pay anything less than the maximum, then you're, you know, anything less than pay the whole thing off, then you're paying ridiculous interest rates. Well, maybe the rates might be a little bit more affordable with law school, but they're tacking on zeros at the end of the amount that you're borrowing.
That's what people don't understand. And that's what's so hard. It's like you go to the grocery store and you're debating between the bougie organic blackberries or the regular blackberries.
And the price is 85 cents different.
Yes. Does that matter? Make that mistake 100 times.
100 times 85 cents is going to be $85.
Yeah.
Then you're thinking about law school.
Yeah. And you just do it too quickly. You're like, oh, but I like the law library there. It looked really.
At a view of the mountains. Ah, yeah. And you're right. Cause we can't, like, our puny mortal brains just, like, you don't know how big 250,000 is.
Oh my gosh. I was talking about 20,000 earlier, and 20,000 is astronomically bigger than $85.
Right.
You could get those organic blackberries for 2 years if you go to the store once a week.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just like start shopping at Whole Foods and never look at the prices. Just buy the stuff that looks the best.
Yeah.
And your grocery bill is going to, instead of being $100, your grocery bill is now $200.
Yeah.
And if you do that every week for a year, you've spent an extra $5,200.
Yeah.
But if you go to law school once, you're going to graduate with a monthly payment of like $2,500.
Yeah.
Monthly.
For, you know, like, 10 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Like easily paying $30,000 a year just to service your student loans.
Oh.
So like, do you shop at Whole Foods? Because if you don't, then you want to think real, real hard about how much money you want to borrow for graduate school.
Yeah.
I hope that Kyle is right, that, you know, he's in contact with a lot of law schools and admissions professionals.
Yeah.
And I hope that he's right, that I still see them as salespeople. I think that their primary job is to sell law school.
Yeah.
And I didn't push back on it, but I would love to believe that these people are more ethical now than they were 10, 15 years ago, and that they really are concerned about how much debt people are going to be taking on. But I was one of those people that 10 years ago, now 15 years ago now, you know, they were like, they literally said to me, you're not going to let money be part of this decision, are you? Now you're not, because I had a scholarship at a different school, and I was like, hey, I'm really concerned about the cost of this. I've got this scholarship at this other school, and I stupidly, I'm asking, you know, the fox for
advice
on how to guard the hen house. And what did they say? I mean, they came right back with, oh, you know, coming to our school, it's a transformative experience, and this is going to shape the whole entire rest of your career. And you don't want to let money, you know, something like money, be an issue at this point in your legal career journey, or whatever bullshit they said. But they definitely convinced me to borrow $150,000.
How much was your scholarship for elsewhere?
It was full or close to full. I mean, and it was,
wow.
I applied real narrowly, right? I applied only to the schools in San Francisco. So that's Golden Gate, USF, Hastings.
Yeah.
And Hastings gave me a tiny nothing scholarship, scammership, you know, $5,000 pat you on the head and make you feel good about
your interest. Right. Yep. Yeah.
And then, these other schools, like, they know that in order to compete, they had to give somebody with a 179 LSAT, they have to give you a scholarship or you're not going to their school that's ranked 100th in the country. Yeah. And I still didn't go to a school that was ranked 100th in the country because I made the huge mistake of getting advice from the law schools themselves, which I definitely want to caution listeners that be real careful where you're getting your advice. And if you're asking the schools themselves what they think about this issue, it's like asking the Mercedes dealer what they think about borrowing money to buy a Mercedes.
Yeah.
You know, that's the best decision they've ever heard of.
Yeah.
It's kind of obvious, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm a pretty smart, like, skeptical, critical thinker. And I was totally susceptible to it. I mean, I fell right into that scam 15 years ago. So that's why I'm, at least from my perspective, and Ben, you seem like you're the same way, but that's why I'm so fired up about doing what we do, because I feel like I'm saving people from a potentially lifetime of debt and really bad financial outcomes for your family that can occur because you borrowed too much money on your education.
Yep.
Cool. Should we leave it there?
We should. Yeah.
Okay. I really want to thank Kyle McEntee of Law School Admission Council for coming on the show. Fantastic guest. Thank you, Kyle. Thank you, everyone, for listening. You can be LSAT famous by asking us questions or sharing news with us at thinkinglsat.com. If you have questions about the LSAT demon, we have the world's best customer service. I dare you to email help@lsatdemon.com and ask us a question about our product. You will be delighted by the service that you get from our team. Please check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 411 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.